As the pickup rolls through French Landing, the din filling the cab makes conversation impossible. Dirty sperm is burning a hole through the marzipan center of Where Did Our Love Go, and in the process committing hideous atrocities upon all those cute little supremes. Henry, who claims to loathe this kind of thing, slouches in his seat, knees up on the dash, hands steepled below his chin, grinning with pleasure. The shops on Chase Street have opened for business, and half a dozen cars jut at an angle from parking spaces. Four boys astride bicycles swerve off the sidewalk before Schmidt's All Sorts and into the road 20 feet in front of the moving pickup. Jack hits his brakes. The boys come to an abrupt halt and line up side by side, waiting for him to pass. Jack trolls forward. Henry straightens up, checks his mysterious sensors, and drops back into position. All is well with Henry. The boys, however, do not know what to make of the uproar growing ever louder as the pickup approaches. They stare at Jack's windshield in bafflement tinged with distaste, the way their great-grandfathers once stared at the Siamese twins and the alligator man in the freak show at the back of the fairground. Everybody knows that the drivers of pickup trucks listen to only two kinds of music, heavy metal or country, so what's with this creep? As Jack drives past the boys, the first, a scowling heavyweight with the inflamed face of a schoolyard bully, displays an upraised second finger. The next two continue the imitations of their great-grandfathers having a hot night out in 1921 and gape, idiotically, mouths slack and open. The fourth boy, whose dark blonde hair beneath a brewer's cap, bright eyes, and general air of innocence make him the nicest-looking of the group, gazes directly into Jack's face and gives him a sweet, tentative smile. This is Tyler Marshall out for a spin, though he is completely unaware of it. Into no man's land. The boys glide into the background, and Jack glances into the mirror to see them pedaling furiously up the street, Sluggo in front, the smallest, most appealing one in the rear already falling behind. A sidewalk panel of experts has reported in on the dirty sperm, Jack says, four kids on bikes. Since he can scarcely make out his words, he does not think Henry will be able to hear them at all. Henry, it seems, has heard imperfectly, and he responds with a question that disappears into the uproar. Having a reasonably good idea of what it must have been, Jack answers it anyhow. One firm negative, two undecideds tending toward negative, and one cautious positive. Henry nods. Violent marzipan destruction crashes and thuds to a conclusion on 11th Street. As if a haze has blown from the cab, as if the windshield has been freshly washed, the air seems clearer, the colors more vibrant. Interesting, Henry says. He reaches unerringly for the eject button, extracts the disc from the holder, and slips it into his case. That was very revealing, don't you think? Raw, self-centered hatred should never be dismissed automatically. Morris Rosen was right. It's perfect for the Wisconsin rat. Hey, I think they could be bigger than Glenn Miller. That reminds me, Henry says. You'll never guess what I'm doing later. I have a gig. Chipper Maxton, actually his second-in-command, this Rebecca Vilas woman, who I am sure is as gorgeous as she sounds, hired me to put on a record hop as the slam-bang climax to Maxton's big strawberry fest. Well, not me. An old, long-neglected persona of mine, Symphonic Stan, the big band man. Do you need a ride? I do not. The wondrous Miss Vilas has attended to my needs in the form of a car with a comfy back seat for my turntable and a trunk spacious enough for the speakers and record cartons, which she will be sending. But thanks anyhow. Symphonic Stan, Jack said. A knocked-out, all-frantic, all-zoot-suit embodiment of the big band era, and a charming, mellifluous gentleman besides, for the residents of Maxton's, an evocation of their salad days, and a joy to behold. Do you actually own a zoot-suit? Magnificently inexpressive, Henry's face swings toward him. Sorry, I don't know what came over me. To change the subject, what you said, I mean what George Rathbun said about the fishermen this morning, probably did a lot of good. I was glad to hear that. Henry opens his mouth and summons George Rathbun in all his avuncular glory. The original fisherman, boys and girls, Albert Fish, has been dead and gone for 67 years. It is uncanny hearing the voice of that charged-up fat man leap from Henry Layden's slender throat. In his own voice, Henry says, "I hope it did some good. After I read your buddy Wendell Green's nonsense in the paper this morning, I thought George had to say something." Henry Layden enjoys using terms like "I read," "I was reading," "I saw," "I was looking at." He knows these phrases disconcert his auditors. And he called Wendell Green your buddy because Henry is the only person to whom Jack has ever admitted that he alerted the reporter to the crimes of Albert Fish. Now Jack wishes he had confessed to no one. Glad-handing Wendell Green is not his buddy. "Having been of some assistance to the press," Henry says, "you might reasonably be thought in a position to do the same for our boys in blue. Forgive me, Jack, but you opened the door, and I'll only say this once. Dale is my nephew, after all." "I don't believe you're doing this to me," Jack says. "Doing what? Speaking my mind? Dale is my nephew, remember? He could use your expertise, and he is very much of the opinion that you owe him a favor. Hasn't it occurred to you that you could help him stay in his job? Or that if you love French Landing and Norway Valley as much as you say, you owe these folks a little of your time and talent? Hasn't it occurred to you, Henry, that I'm retired?" Jack says through gritted teeth, "that investigating homicides is the last thing, I mean the last thing in the world I want to do?" "Of course it has," Henry says. "But, and again, I hope you'll forgive me, Jack. Here you are, the person I know you are, with the skills you have, which are certainly far beyond Dale's and probably well beyond all these other guys, and I can't help wondering what the hell your problem is." "I don't have a problem," Jack says. "I'm a civilian." "You're the boss." "We might as well listen to the rest of the Barenboim." Henry runs his fingers over the console and pushes the button for the tuner. For the next 15 minutes, the only voice to be heard in the pickup's cab is that of a Steinway concert grand meditating upon the Goldberg variations in the Teatro Colón, Buenos Aires. A splendid voice it is, too, Jack thinks, and you'd have to be an ignoramus to mistake it for Glenn Gould. A person capable of making that mistake probably couldn't hear the vibration-like inner sound produced by a General Motors door handle. When they turn right off Highway 93 into Norway Valley Road, Henry says, "Stop sulking. I shouldn't have called you a schmuck. And I shouldn't have accused you of having a problem because I'm the one with the problem." "You?" Jack looks at him, startled. Long experience has immediately suggested that Henry is about to ask for some kind of unofficial investigative help. Henry is facing the windshield, giving nothing away. "What kind of problem can you have? Did your socks get out of order? Oh, are you having trouble with one of the stations?" "That I could deal with." Henry pauses, and the pause stretches into a lengthy silence. "What I was going to say is, I feel like I'm losing my mind. I think I'm going sort of crazy." "Come on." Jack eases up on the gas pedal and cuts his speed in half. "Has Henry witnessed a feather explosion?" "Of course he hasn't. Henry cannot see anything, and his own feather explosion was merely a waking dream." Henry quivers like a tuning fork. He is still facing the windshield. "Tell me what's going on," Jack says. "I'm starting to worry about you." Henry opens his mouth to a crack that might accommodate a communion wafer, then closes it again. Another tremor runs through him. "Hmm," he says. "This is harder than I thought." Astonishingly, his dry, measured voice, the true voice of Henry Layden, wobbles with a wide, helpless vibrato. Jack slows the pickup to a crawl, begins to say something, and decides to wait. "I hear my wife," Henry says, "at night when I'm lying in bed, around 3-4 in the morning. Rhoda's footsteps are moving around in the kitchen. They're coming up the stairs. I must be losing my mind." "How often does this happen?" "How many times? I don't know exactly. 3 or 4. "Do you get up and look for her? Call out her name?" Henry's voice again sails up and down on the vibrato trampoline. "I've done both those things, because I was sure I heard her. Her footsteps, her way of walking, her tread. Rhoda's been gone for 6 years now. Pretty funny, huh? I'd think it was funny if I didn't think I was going bats. You call out her name, Jack says, and you get out of bed and go downstairs. Like a lunatic. Like a madman. Rhoda, is that you, Rhoda? Last night I went all around the house. Rhoda, Rhoda, you'd think I was expecting her to answer. Henry pays no attention to the tears that leak from beneath his aviator glasses and slip down his cheeks. And I was. That's the problem. No one else was in the house, Jack says. No signs of disturbance, nothing misplaced or missing or anything like that. Not as far as I saw. Everything was still where it should have been, right where I left it. He raises a hand and wipes his face. The entrance to Jack's looping driveway slides past on the right side of the cab. I'll tell you what I think, Jack says, picturing Henry wandering through his darkened house. 6 years ago, you went through all the grief business that happens when someone you love dies and leaves you. The denial, the bargaining, the anger, the pain, whatever, acceptance, that whole range of emotions. But afterward, you still missed Rhoda. No one ever says you keep on missing the dead people you loved, but you do. Now that's profound, Henry says, and comforting, too. Don't interrupt. Weirdness happens. Believe me, I know what I'm talking about. Your mind rebels. It distorts the evidence. It gives false testimony. Who knows why? It just does. In other words, you go batshit, Henry says. I believe that is where we came in. What I mean, Jack says, is that people can have waking dreams. That's what is happening to you. It's nothing to worry about. All right, here's your drive. You're home. He turns into the grassy entrance and rolls up to the white farmhouse in which Henry and Rhoda Layden had spent the 15 lively years between their marriage and the discovery of Rhoda's liver cancer. For nearly 2 years after her death, Henry went wandering through his house every evening, turning on the lights. Waking dreams? Where'd you get that one? Waking dreams aren't uncommon, Jack says, especially in people who never get enough sleep, like you. Or like me, he silently adds. I'm not making this up, Henry. I've had one or two myself. One, anyhow. Waking dreams, Henry says in a different, considering tone of voice. Ivy divey. Think about it. We live in a rational world. People do not return from the dead. Everything happens for a reason, and the reasons are always rational. It's a matter of chemistry or coincidence. If they weren't rational, we'd never figure anything out, and we'd never know what was going on. Even a blind man can see that, Henry says. Thanks. Words to live by. He gets out of the cab and closes the door. He moves away, steps back, and leans in through the window. Do you want to start on Bleak House tonight? I should get home about 8:30, something like that. I'll turn up around 9. By way of parting, Henry says, ding dong. He turns away, walks to his doorstep, and disappears into his house, which is, of course, unlocked. Around here, only parents lock their doors, and even that's a new development. Jack reverses the pickup, swings down the drive, and onto Norway Valley Road. He feels as though he has done a doubly good deed, for by helping Henry, he has also helped himself. It's nice how things turn out sometimes. When he turns into his own long driveway, a peculiar rattle comes from the ashtray beneath his dashboard. He hears it again at the last curve, just before his house comes into view. The sound is not so much a rattle as a small, dull clunk. A button, a coin, something like that. He rolls to a stop at the side of his house, turns off the engine, and opens his door. On an afterthought, he reaches over and pulls out the ashtray. What Jack finds, nestled in the grooves at the bottom of the sliding tray, a tiny robin's egg, a robin's egg the size of an almond M&M, expels all the air from his body. The little egg is so blue, a blind man could see it. Jack's trembling fingers pluck the egg from the ashtray. Staring at it, he leaves the cab and closes the door. Still staring at the egg, he finally remembers to breathe. His hand revolves on his wrist and releases the egg, which falls in a straight line to the grass. Deliberately, he lifts his foot and smashes it down onto the obscene blue speck. Without looking back, he pockets his keys and moves toward the dubious safety of his house. Part 2. The Taking of Tyler Marshall. Chapter 5. We glimpsed a janitor on our whirlwind early morning tour of Maxton Elder Care. Do you happen to remember him? Baggy overalls a wee bit thick in the gut, dangling cigarette in spite of the no-smoking lungs-at-work signs that have been posted every 20 feet or so along the patient corridors, a mop that looks like a clot of dead spiders. No? Don't apologize. It's easy enough to overlook Pete Wexler, a one-time nondescript youth, final grade average at French Landing High School 79, who passed through a nondescript young manhood and has now reached the edge of what he expects to be a nondescript middle age. His only hobby is administering the occasional secret savage pinch to the moldy oldies that fill his days with their grunts, nonsensical questions, and smells of gas and piss. The Alzheimer's assholes are the worst. He has been known to stub out the occasional cigarette on their scrawny backs or buttocks. He likes their strangled cries when the heat hits and the pain cores in. This small and ugly torture has a double-barreled effect. It wakes them up a little and satisfies something in him. Brightens his days, somehow. Refreshes the old outlook. Besides, who are they going to tell? And, oh, God, there goes the worst of them now, shuffling slowly down the corridor of Daisy. Charles Burnside's mouth is agape, as is the back of his Johnny. Pete has a better view of Burnside's scrawny, shit-smeared buttocks than he ever wanted. The chocolate stains go all the way down to the backs of his knees, by God. He's headed for the bathroom, but it's just a little bit late. A certain brown horse, call him Morning Thunder, has already bolted from its stall and no doubt galloped across Bernie's sheets. Thank God cleaning him up isn't my job, Pete thinks, and smirks around his cigarette. Over to you, Butch. But the desk up there by the little boys' and girls' rooms is, for the time being, unattended. Butch Yerxa is going to miss the charming sight of Bernie's dirty ass sailing by. Butch has apparently stepped out for a smoke. Although Pete has told the idiot 100 times that all those no-smoking signs mean nothing, Chipper Maxton could care less about who smoked where or where the smokes were butted out, for that matter. The signs are just there to keep good old drooler manner in compliance with certain tiresome state laws. Pete's smirk widens, and at that moment he looks a good deal like his son, Ebby, Tyler Marshall's sometime friend. It was Ebby Wexler, in fact, who just gave Jack and Henry the finger. Pete is wondering whether he should go out and tell Butch he's got a little cleanup job in D-18, plus D-18's occupant, of course, or if he should just let Butch discover Bernie's latest mess on his own. Perhaps Bernie will go back to his room and do a little finger painting, kind of spread the joy around. That would be good, but it would also be good to see Butch's face fall when Pete told him. Pete? Oh, no, sandbagged by the bitch. She's a fine-looking bitch, but a bitch is still a bitch. Pete stands where he is for a moment, thinking that maybe if he ignores her, she'll go away. Vain hope. Pete, he turns. There is Rebecca Vilas, current squeeze of the big cheese. Today she is wearing a light red dress, perhaps in honor of Strawberry Fest, and black high-heeled pumps, probably in honor of her own fine gams. Pete briefly imagines those fine gams wrapped around him, those high heels crossed at the small of his back and pointing like clock hands, then sees the cardboard box she's holding in her arms. Work for him, no doubt. Pete also notes the glinting ring on her finger, some sort of gemstone the size of a goddamn robin's egg, although considerably paler. He wonders, not for the first time, just what a woman does to earn a ring like that. She stands there, tapping her foot, letting him have his look. Behind him, Charles Burnside continues his slow, tottery progress toward the men's. You'd think, looking at that old wreck with his scrawny legs and flyaway milkweed hair, that his running days were long behind him. But you'd be wrong. Terribly wrong. "Miss Vilas?" Pete says at last. "Common room, Pete, on the double. And how many times have you been told not to smoke in the patient wings?" Before he can reply, she turns with a sexy little flirt of the skirt and starts off toward the Maxton common room, where that afternoon's Strawberry Fest dance will be held. Sighing, Pete props his broom against the wall and follows her. Charles Burnside is now alone at the head of the Daisy Corridor. The vacancy leaves his eyes and is replaced with a brilliant and feral gleam of intelligence. All at once, he looks younger. All at once, Bernie the human shit machine is gone. In his place is Carl Bierstone, who reaped the young in Chicago with such savage efficiency. Carl, and something else, something not human. It grins. On the unattended desk is a pile of paper weighed down with a round stone the size of a coffee cup. Written on the stone in small black letters is Butch's Pet Rock. Bernie picks up Butch Yerxa's Pet Rock and walks briskly toward the men's room, still grinning. In the common room, the tables have been arranged around the walls and covered with red paper cloths. Later, Pete will add small red lights, battery-powered, no candles for the droolers, gosh no. On the walls, great big cardboard strawberries have been taped up everywhere, some looking rather battered. They have been put up and taken down every July since Herbert Maxton opened this place at the end of the swinging 60s. The linoleum floor is open and bare. This afternoon and early evening, the moldy oldies who are still ambulatory and of a mind to do so will shuffle around out there to the big band sounds of the 30s and 40s, clinging to each other during the slow numbers and probably dampening their depends with excitement at the end of the jitterbugs. 3 years ago, a moldy oldie named Irving Christie had a minor heart attack after doing a particularly strenuous Lindy Hop to Don't Sit Under the Apple Tree with Anyone Else But Me. Oh, yes, the Strawberry Fest Hop is always exciting. Rebecca has, all by herself, pushed together 3 wooden flats and covered them with a white cloth, creating the basis for Symphonic Stan's podium. In the corner stands a brilliantly chromed microphone with a large, round head, a genuine antique from the 30s that saw service at the Cotton Club. It is one of Henry Layden's prized possessions. Beside it is the tall, narrow carton in which it arrived yesterday. On the podium, beneath a beam decorated with red and white crepe and more cardboard strawberries, is a stepladder. Seeing it, Pete feels a moment's possessive jealousy. Rebecca Vilas has been in his closet. Trespassing bitch. If she stole any of his weed, by God. Rebecca sets her carton down on the podium with an audible grunt, then straightens up. She brushes a lock of silky chestnut hair off one flushed cheek. It's only mid-morning, but the day is going to be a genuine coolie country scorcher. Air condition your underwear and double up on the deodorant, folks, as George Rathbun has been known to bellow. "I thought you'd never come, me fine bucko," Rebecca says. "Well, I'm here," Pete says sullenly. "Looks like you're doing fine without me." He pauses, then adds, "Fine." For Pete, this is quite a witticism. He walks forward and peers into the carton, which, like the one by the mic, is stamped property of Henry Layden. Inside the box is a small spotlight with an electrical cord wrapped around it and a circular pink gel that is meant to turn the light the color of candy canes and sugar strawberries. "What's this shit?" Pete asks. Rebecca gives him a brilliant, dangerous smile. Even to a relatively dull fellow like Pete, the message of that smile is clear. You're on the edge of the gator pool, buddy. How many more steps do you want to take? "Light," she says, "L-I-G-H-T. Hangs up there on that hook, H-O-O-K. It's something the DJ insists on. Says it gets him in the mood, M-O-O. What happened to Weenie Erickson?" Pete grumbles. There was none of this shit with Weenie. He played the goddamn records for 2 hours, had a few out of his hip flask, then shut it down. He moved, Rebecca says indifferently. Racine, I think. Well, Pete is looking up, studying the beam with its intertwined fluffs of red and white crepe. I don't see no hook, Miss Vilas. Christ on a bicycle, she says, and mounts the stepladder. Here, are you blind? Pete, most definitely not blind, has rarely been so grateful for his sighted state. From his position below her, he's got a clear view of her thighs, the red lace froth of her panties, and the twin curves of her buttocks, now nicely tensed as she stands on the fifth step of the ladder. She looks down at him, sees the stunned look on his face, notes the direction of his sight line. Her expression softens a bit. As her dear mither so wisely observed, some men are just fools for a flash of panty. Pete, earth to Pete. Ah? He looks up at her, mouth hanging agape, a dot of spittle on his lower lip. There is no hook of any kind on my underwear. I'm sure of that as of few things in life. But if you will direct your gaze upward to my hand instead of my ass. He looks up, face still dazed, and sees one red-tipped nail. Rebecca is a through-and-through vision in strawberry red today, no doubt about it. Tapping a hook that just gleams out of the crepe, like a fisherman's hook gleaming murderously out of a gaudy lure. Hook, she says. Attach gel to light, attach light to hook. Light becomes warm pink spotlight as per DJ's explicit instructions. You get a message, Kimosabe? Yeah. Then, if I may coin a phrase, will you please get it up? She comes down the ladder, deciding Pete Wexler has gotten the biggest free show he can reasonably expect for one lousy chore. And Pete, who has already achieved one erection, pulls Symphonic Stan's pink pin spot out of its box and prepares to achieve another. As he mounts the stepladder, his crotch rises past Rebecca's face. She notes the bulge there and gnaws the inside of one cheek to suppress a smile. Men are fools, all right. Lovable fools, some of them, but fools all the same. It's just that some fools can afford rings and trips and midnight suppers at Milwaukee night spots, and some fools cannot. With some fools, the best you can get them to do is put up a lousy light. Wait up, you guys, Time Marshall calls. Ebby, Ronnie, TJ, wait up. Over his shoulder, Ebby Wexler, who really does look like Nancy's not-too-bright boyfriend Sluggo, calls back, catch us, Slowpoke. Yeah, Ronnie Metzger yells, catch us, Po-Sloke. Ronnie, a kid with a lot of hours in the speech therapy room ahead of him, looks back over his own shoulder, almost crashes his bike into a parking meter, and just manages to swerve around it. Then they are fleeing, the three of them filling the sidewalk with their bikes. God help the pedestrian headed the other way, their racing shadows fleeing beside them. Tyler considers a final catch-up dash, then decides his legs are just too tired. His mother and father say that he will catch up in time, that he's just small for his age. But brother Ty has his doubts. And he has had increasing doubts about Ebby, Ronnie, and TJ, too. Are they really worth keeping up with? If Judy Marshall knew of these doubts, she would stand and applaud. She has wondered for the last 2 years when her bright and thoughtful son will finally tire of hanging out with such a bunch of losers, what she calls low raiders. Suck an elf, Ty says disconsolately. He has picked up this harmless vulgarity from Sci-Fi Channel reruns of a miniseries called The Tenth Kingdom, and dismounts his bike. There's no real reason to speed after them anyway. He knows where he'll find them, in the parking lot of the 7-Eleven, drinking Slurpees and trading magic cards. This is another problem Tyler is having with his friends. These days, he'd much rather trade baseball cards. Ebby, Ronnie, and TJ could care less about the Cardinals, the Indians, the Red Sox, and the Brew Crew. Ebby has gone so far as to say that baseball is gay, a comment Ty considers stupid, almost pitiable, rather than outrageous. He walks his bike slowly up the sidewalk, catching his breath. Here is the intersection of Chase and Queen Streets. Ebby calls Queen Street Queer Street, Of course, no surprise there. And isn't that a big part of the problem? Tyler is a boy who likes surprises. Ebby Wexler is a boy who doesn't. Which makes their opposite reactions to the music pouring out of the pickup a little earlier that morning perfectly predictable. Tyler pauses at the corner, looking down Queen Street. There are shaggy hedges on both sides. Above those on the right rise a number of interconnected red roofs. The old folks' home. Beside the main gate, some sort of sign has been placed. Curious, Tyler remounts his bike and rides slowly down the sidewalk for a look. The longest branches of the hedge beside him whisper against the handlebar of his bike. The sign turns out to be a great big strawberry. Strawberry Fest today is written below it. What, Time Marshall wonders, is a strawberry fest? A party, something strictly for old folks? It's a question, but not a very interesting one. After mulling it over for a few seconds, he turns his bike and prepares to ride back down to Chase Street. Charles Burnside enters the men's room at the head of the Daisy Corridor, still grinning and clutching Butch's pet rock. To his right is a line of sinks with a mirror over each one. They are the sort of metal mirrors one finds in the toilets of the lower-class bars and saloons. In one of these, Bernie sees his own grinning reflection. In another, the one closest the window, he sees a small boy in a Milwaukee Brewers t-shirt. The boy is standing astride his bike, just outside the gate, reading the Strawberry Fest sign. Bernie begins to drool. There is nothing discreet about it either. Bernie drools like a wolf in a fairy tale, white curds of foamy spit leaking from the corners of his mouth and flowing over the slack, liver-colored roll of his lower lip. The drool runs down his chin like a stream of soap suds. He wipes at it absently with the back of one gnarled hand and shakes it to the floor in a splatter, never taking his eyes from the mirror. The boy in the mirror is not one of this creature's poor lost babies. Time Marshall has lived in French Landing his whole life and knows exactly where he is. But he could be. He could very easily become lost and wind up in a certain room, a certain cell, or trudging toward a strange horizon on burning, bleeding footsies. Especially if Bernie has his way. He will have to move fast. But as we have already noted, Charles Burnside can, with the proper motivation, move very fast indeed. Gorg, he says to the mirror. He speaks this nonsense word in a perfectly clear, perfectly flat Midwestern accent. Come, Gorg. And without waiting to see what comes next, he knows what comes next. Bernie turns and walks toward the line of four toilet stalls. He steps into the second from the left and closes the door. Tyler has just remounted his bike when the hedge rustles 10 feet from the Strawberry Fest sign. A large black crow shrugs its way out of the greenery and onto the Queen Street sidewalk. It regards the boy with a lively, intelligent eye. It stands with its black legs spread, opens its beak, and speaks. Gorg. Tyler looks at it, beginning to smile. Not sure he heard this, but ready to be delighted. At 10, he's always ready to be delighted, always primed to believe the unbelievable. What? Did you say something? The crow flutters its glossy wings and cocks its head in a way that renders the ugly almost charming. Gorg. Ty. The boy laughs. It said his name. The crow said his name. He dismounts his bike, puts it on the kickstand, and takes a couple of steps toward the crow. Thoughts of Amy St. Pierre and Johnny Erkenham are, unfortunately, the furthest things from his mind. He thinks the crow will surely fly away when he steps toward it, but it only flutters its wings a little and takes a slide step toward the bushy darkness of the hedge. Did you say my name? Gorg, Tai, Abala. For a moment, Ty's smile falters. That last word is almost familiar to him, and the associations, although faint, are not exactly pleasant. It makes him think of his mother for some reason. Then the crow says his name again. Surely it is saying Ty. Tyler takes another step away from Queen Street and toward the blackbird. The crow takes a corresponding step, sidling closer still to the bulk of the hedge. There is no one on the street. This part of French Landing is dreaming in the morning sunshine. Ty takes another step toward his doom, and all the worlds tremble. Ebby, Ronnie, and TJ come swaggering out of the 7-Eleven, where the raghead behind the counter has just served them blueberry slurpees. Raghead is just one of many pejorative terms Ebby has picked up from his dad. They also have fresh packs of magic cards, two packs each. Ebby, his lips already smeared blue, turns to TJ. Go on down street and get the slowpoke. TJ looks injured. Why me? Because Ronnie bought the cards, dumbwit. Go on, hurry up. Why do we need him, Ebby? Ronnie asks. He leans against the bike rack, noshing on the cold, sweet chips of ice. Because I say so, Ebby replies loftily. The fact is, Tyler Marshall usually has money on Fridays. In fact, Tyler has money almost every day. His parents are loaded. Ebby, who is being raised, if you can call it that, by a single father who has a crappy janitor's job, has already conceived a vague hate for Tyler on this account. The first humiliations aren't far away, and the first beatings will follow soon after. But now all he wants are more magic cards, a third pack for each of them. The fact that Tyler doesn't even like magic that much will only make getting him to pony up that much sweeter. But first they have to get the little slowpoke up here, or the little po-sloke, as mush-mouthed Ronnie calls him. Ebby likes that and thinks he'll start using it. Po-sloke, a good word, makes fun of Ty and Ronnie at the same time, two for the price of one. Go on, TJ, unless you want an Indian burn. TJ doesn't. Ebby Wexler's Indian burns hurt like a mad bastard. He gives a theatrical sigh, backs his bike out of the rack, mounts it, and rides back down the mild slope of the hill, holding a handlebar in one hand and his Slurpee in the other. He expects to see Ty right away, probably walking his bike because he's just so tired. But Ty doesn't seem to be on Chase Street at all. What's up with that? TJ pedals a little faster. In the men's room, we are now looking at the line of toilet stalls. The door of the one second from the left is closed. The other three stand ajar on their chrome hinges. Beneath the closed door, we see a pair of gnarled, veiny ankles rising from a pair of filthy slippers. A voice cries out with surprising strength. It is a young man's voice, hoarse, hungry, and angry. It echoes flatly back from the tile walls. Abala, Abala Dune, Munchungorg. Suddenly the toilets flush. Not just the one in the closed cubicle, but all of them. Across the room, the urinals also flush, their chromed handles dipping in perfect synchronicity. Water runs down their curved porcelain surfaces. When we look back from the urinals to the toilets, we see that the dirty slippers and the feet that were in them are gone. And for the first time, we have actually heard the sound of slippage, a kind of hot exhale, the sort of sound one hears escaping one's lungs when waking from a nightmare at 2 a.m. Ladies and gentlemen, Charles Burnside has left the building. The crow has backed right up against the hedge now. Still, it regards Tyler with its bright, eerie eyes. Tyler steps forward toward it, feeling hypnotized. Say my name again, he breathes. Say my name again and you can go. Die, the crow croaks obligingly, then gives its wings a little shake and slips into the hedge. For a moment, Tyler can still see it, a mixture of shiny black and the shiny green, and then it's gone. Holy crow, Tyler says. He realizes what he said and gives a small, shaky laugh. Did it happen? It did, didn't it? He leans closer to where the crow re-entered the hedge, thinking if it shed a feather, he will take it for a souvenir. And when he does, a scrawny white arm shoots out through the green and seizes him unerringly by the neck. Tyler has time to give a single terrified squawk, and then he is dragged through the hedge. One of his sneakers is pulled off by the short, stiff branches. From the far side, there is a single, guttural, greedy cry. It might have been, "Boy!" And then a thud, the sound of a pet rock coming down on a small boy's head, perhaps. Then there's nothing but the distant drone of a lawnmower and the closer drone of a bee. The bee is bumbling around the flowers on the far side of the hedge, the Maxton side. There is nothing else to be seen over there but green grass, and closer to the building, the tables where the elderly inhabitants will, at noon, sit down to the Strawberry Fest picnic. Tyler Marshall is gone. T.J. Reniker coasts to a stop at the corner of Chase and Queen. His Slurpee is dripping dark blue juice over his wrist, but he barely notices. Halfway down Queen Street, he sees Ty's bike leaning neatly over on its kickstand. But no Ty. Moving slowly, he has a bad feeling about this somehow. TJ rides over to the bike. At some point, he becomes aware that what was a Slurpee has now dissolved into a soggy cup of melting goop. He tosses it into the gutter. It's Ty's ride, all right. No mistaking that red 20-inch Schwinn with the ape hanger handlebars and the green Milwaukee Bucks decal on the side. The bike and, lying on its side, by the hedge that creates a border between the world of the old folks and the world of regular people, the real people, TJ sees a single Reebok sneaker lying on its side. Scattered around it are a number of shiny green leaves. One feather protrudes from the sneaker. The boy stares at this sneaker with wide eyes. TJ may not be as smart as Tyler, but he's a few watts brighter than Ebby Wexler, and it's easy enough for him to imagine Tyler being dragged through the hedge, leaving his bike behind, and one sneaker, one lonely, overturned sneaker. "Ty," he calls, "are you joking around? Because if you are, you better stop. I'll tell Ebby to give you the biggest Indian burn you ever had." No answer. Ty isn't joking around. TJ somehow knows it. Thoughts of Amy St. Pierre and Johnny Erkenham suddenly explode in TJ's mind. He hears, or imagines he hears, stealthy footsteps behind the hedge. The fisherman, having secured dinner, has come back for dessert. TJ tries to scream and cannot. His throat has shrunk down to a pinhole. Instead of screaming, he whirls himself onto the seat of his bike and begins pedaling. He swerves off the sidewalk and into the street, wanting to get away from the dark bulk of that hedge just as fast as he can. When he leaves the curb, the front tire of his huffy bike squashes through the remains of his Slurpee. As he pedals toward Chase Street, bent over his handlebars like a Grand Prix racer, he leaves a dark and shiny track on the pavement. It looks like blood. Somewhere nearby, a crow caws. It sounds like laughter. 16 Robin Hood Lane. We've been here before, as the chorus girl said to the Archbishop. Peek through the kitchen window and we see Judy Marshall asleep in the rocking chair in the corner. There's a book in her lap, the John Grisham novel we last saw on her bedside table. Sitting beside her on the floor is half a cup of cold coffee. Judy managed to read 10 pages before dozing off. We shouldn't blame Mr. Grisham's narrative skills. Judy had a hard night last night, and it's not the first. It's been over 2 months since she last got more than 2 hours of sleep in one stretch. Fred knows something is wrong with his wife, but has no idea how deep it runs. If he did, he would be a lot more frightened. Soon, God help him, is going to have a better picture of her mental state. Now she begins to moan thickly and to turn her head from side to side. Those nonsense words begin to issue from her again. Most of them are too sleep fuzzy to understand, but we catch Abala and Gorg. Her eyes suddenly flash open. They are a brilliant royal blue in the morning light, which fills the kitchen with summer's dusty gold. "Ty!" she gasps, and her feet give a convulsive waking jerk. She looks at the clock over the stove. It is 9:12, and everything seems twisted, as it so often does when we sleep deeply but not well or long. She has sucked some miserable, not quite a nightmare dream after her, like mucusy strings of afterbirth. Men with fedora hats pulled down so as to shadow their faces, walking on long R-crumb legs that ended in big, round-toed R-crumb shoes. Sinister keep-on-truckin' sharpies who move too fast against a city background, Milwaukee, Chicago, and in front of a baleful orange sky. The dream soundtrack was the Benny Goodman Band playing King Porter Stomp, the one her father had always played when he was getting a little shot, and the feeling of the dream had been a terrible Darkwood mix of terror and grief. Awful things had happened, but the worst was waiting. There's none of the relief people usually feel upon waking from bad dreams, the relief she herself had felt when she had been younger and sane. She says in a croaky, just-woke-up voice. King Porter Stomp. Think of that. To her, it had always sounded like the music you heard in the old cartoons, the ones where mice in white gloves ran in and out of rat holes with dizzying, feverish speed. Once, when her father was dancing her around to that one, she had felt something hard poking against her, something in his pants. After that, when he put on his dance music, she tried to be somewhere else. "Quit it," she says in the same croaky voice. It's a crow's voice, and it occurs to her that there was a crow in her dream. Sure, you bet. The crow Gorg.
"Gorg means death," she says,
and licks her dry upper lip without realizing it. Her tongue comes out even farther, and on the return swipe the tip licks across her nostrils, warm and wet and somehow comforting.
"Over there, Gorg means death. Over there in the..."
Far away is the word she doesn't say. Before she can, she sees something on the kitchen table that wasn't there before. It's a wicker box. A sound is coming from it, some low, sleepy sound. Distress worms into her lower belly, making her bowels feel loose and watery. She knows what a box like that is called, a creel. It's a fisherman's creel. There is a fisherman in French Landing these days. A bad fisherman.
"Ty?"
she calls, but of course there is no answer. The house is empty except for her. Dale is at work and Ty will be out playing, you bet. It's 9:30, the heart of summer vacation, and Ty will be rolling around the town doing all the Ray Bradbury, August Derleth things boys do when they've got the whole endless summer day to do them in. But he won't be alone. Dale has talked with him about buddying up until the fisherman is caught, at least until then, and so has she. Judy has no great liking for the Wexler kid, the Metzger or Reneker kids either. But there's safety in numbers. Ty probably isn't having any great cultural awakenings this summer, but at least
he's safe,
she says in her croaky, crow-gorg voice. Yet the box that has appeared on the kitchen table during her nap seems to deny that, to negate the whole concept of safety. Where did it come from? And what is the white thing on top of it?
"A note," she says,
and gets up. She crosses the short length of floor between the rocker and the table like someone still in a dream. The note is a piece of paper folded over. Written across the half she can see is Sweet Judy Blue Eyes. In college, just before meeting Dale, she had a boyfriend who used to call her that. She asked him to stop. It was annoying, sappy. And when he kept forgetting, on purpose, she suspected, she dropped him like a rock. Now here it is again, that stupid nickname mocking her. Judy turns on the sink tap without taking her eyes from the note, fills her cupped hand with cold water and drinks. A few drops fall on sweet Judy Blue Eyes, and the name smears at once. Written in fountain pen ink? How antique. Who writes with a fountain pen these days? She reaches for the note, then draws back. The sound from inside the box is louder now. It's a humming sound. It's flies, she says. Her throat has been refreshed by the water, and her voice isn't so croaky, but to herself, Judy still sounds like the crow Gorg. You know the sound of flies. Get the note. Don't want to. Yes, but you need to. Now get it. What happened to your guts, you little chicken shit? Good question. Fucking good question. Judy's tongue comes out, slathers her upper lip and philtrum. Then she takes the note and unfolds it. Sorry, there is only one kidney. The other I fried and ate. It was very good. The fisherman. The nerves in Judy Marshall's fingers, palms, wrists, and forearms suddenly shut down. The color drops so completely from her face that the blue veins in her cheeks become visible. It's surely a miracle that she doesn't pass out. The note drops from her fingers and goes seesawing to the floor. Shrieking her son's name over and over again, she throws back the lid of the fisherman's creel. Inside are shiny red coils of intestine crawling with flies. There are the wrinkled sacks of lungs and the fist-sized pump that was a child's heart. There is the thick purple pad of a liver and one kidney. This mess of guts is crawling with flies, and all the world is Gorg, is Gorg, is Gorg. In the sunny stillness of her kitchen, Judy Marshall now begins to howl. And it is the sound of madness, finally broken free of its flimsy cage. Madness unbound.